Funny thing happened at a high-tech conference I went to last fall.
I'm Asimov, a humanoid robot. It is a pleasure to meet you.
This was the Global Mobile Internet Conference in San Francisco. This conference, and others like it in Beijing, Tokyo, Taipei, Tel Aviv, Jakarta, Sao Paulo, and Bangalore, are run by a group called GWC, the Great Wall Club. It was started 8 years ago by a group of mostly Chinese entrepreneurs with the goal of bringing together innovators and business leaders to share ideas. Since then, tens of thousands of people have attended one of these conferences. I've been to a few in Beijing and San Francisco, and I found them to be really pretty useful as a way of keeping up with what's new in tech in China and beyond. Of course, with the news and conversation at such gatherings comes a little hype. China as great center of shape-shifting innovation, China as inevitable rising global power in tech and in general. The narrative is pretty consistent in most of the sessions. Except for one that I went to on the last afternoon of the three-day conference in San Francisco. And I apologize for the sound quality. The organizers wouldn't let me plug into the audio system, and though a video of this particular session was up for a while on YouTube with their audio, they took it down, citing copyright infringement. Interestingly, they didn't take down other sessions from this same conference. Anyway, the session started like this.
Gentlemen, I'm here to take you on a small journey to tell you why Silicon Valley is about to be Bangalore and disrupted. I'm calling it Why India Rocks.
This is Srivatsa Krishna. He's a Harvard Business School educated official in Bangalore, and he heads the e-governance department in the state of Karnataka, in which Bangalore is the capital.
And I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about India to set the context, and then go into Bangalore and tell you why Bangalore roars, and why Silicon Valley, better watch out, we are coming. By 2020, a recent McKinsey study says, we'll become the single largest cluster on the planet, overtaking Silicon Valley, with 2 million IT professionals, 6 million indirect IT jobs, and 80 billion in exports. Out of one city, Bangalore, India's exports are supposed to hit about 200 billion, and we'll be doing 40% of that in another 5 years. We are today at about 36% of India's total exports in the IT knowledge software industry.
Srivatsa made his pitch with confidence, maybe a little swagger. He threw in a joke about how Chinese have to check in with the teachings of Chairman Mao before they can answer a simple question, and how it's Indians who have the true entrepreneurial spirit. Aside from being out of date, it seemed to put the audience on edge.
Just to be a little bit more objective, now I have New York Times, and according to the World Health Organization, that one in five drugs made in India are fakes. Mm-hmm. And also electronics is number one that, you know, imported from India and is fake in the US market.
So I'm not debating that data. What I'm saying is every country has different problems, and we have ours. We have problems of infant mortality. Can I answer?
I had to snicker to myself that India was being criticized for making fake pharmaceuticals when China has long had its own epic problems with fakes. There were more questions asking how India could possibly out-innovate China. Questioners broke in as Srivatsa Krishna was talking, kind of heckled him. He handled it with grace. At the end, he invited people to come to Bangalore and see for themselves what was happening there. And I thought, why not? This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And look, if you go to central Bangalore and compare it to Beijing, where I used to live, it looks like it's from another era. Beijing has its big modern high-rises and broad boulevards. Central Bangalore looks almost village-like, with stray dogs ambling past the charred remains of campfires on uneven sidewalks, small shops with whimsical signs, motorized trishaws and squatting street vendors. And this all contrasts with the grand, imposing white colonial buildings dating back from the British Raj, now used by the local government. But don't be fooled. Bangalore is a city of about 11.5 million people, double the population 15 years ago, with an infrastructure that gets better as you travel out and hit the newer parts of town. There are lots of young, educated, ambitious entrepreneurs drawn by the energy and opportunity here. And the energy here reminds me of how China felt a decade ago. I visited Srivatsa Krishna in his government office. He got me some coffee, we sat down, and I asked, you know all those questions after your talk in San Francisco? Do you get challenged that way often?
No, I don't. Actually, it was a surprise. But the fact remains that there's data, and that can be always shown. And if you believe the data, data is not our data. It's data by international organizations like the World Bank. Yeah. So I think there's absolutely no gainsaying the fact that India is at least 20 years, I would say 100 years, behind China in physical infrastructure. And I'm the first to admit it. I did so in that presentation as well. But we are 100 years ahead of them in innovation, knowledge, and the IT economy. And this hasn't happened overnight. This has been going on for the last 25, 30 years to reach where we have reached today. And the good news for India is it has only scratched a very, very small bit of the global pie. And the way ahead is long. The rewards are many and very, very fruitful. But so are the risks, and we are fully aware of that.
So this is a story about the other Asian giant, the one that's going to have a bigger population than China in about 5 years, the one that already has a higher economic growth rate. This is about how India may reap its own rewards in this century, how, if this does become the Asian century, it might not happen in quite the way China's leaders have long been expecting. Consider this about India. About half of all Indians are under age 25. In China, the working population is not just aging, it's contracting. Meanwhile, India is about to get the same kind of demographic dividend that China enjoyed during its 3 decades of go-go growth, but with the added bonus that most young Indians are digital natives.
They're the sinews of India's digital revolution. It's only a matter of time before all of them enter the workforce in the knowledge ecosystem, as I put it. It's not just IT. It's a whole bunch of things, bioinformatics, anywhere where ideas collide with people, where there's an opportunity for a person to take an idea and scale it up. I think India will have a huge edge over everybody else.
To help speed that along, the Indian government is working on connecting people and cutting red tape. At the national level, it's issuing biometric ID cards called Aadhaar. At the local level, in the state of Karnataka, there's an e-governance initiative that has put government procurement online to cut down on corruption and favoritism. And a new system, called One Mobile, allows residents to do much of their business with the government on their mobile phones, get benefits, contact officials, make tax payments, file complaints.
What is missing in this puzzle, which too I think will happen, is internet connectivity to 1 billion people. I expect the next 5 years will see that happen. I'm quite sure by 2021, if not sooner, by 2020, we will have every home in India connected with a true broadband pipe. There are various measures of that, how big that pipe would be. Some say every habitation will have 2 GB. Some say every house will have 2 MB. Now, I don't know. There are various models being played around with. But at the end of the day, in 5 to 6 years, every Indian will have the ability to get on the internet and transact, play, entertain, do business if he wishes to. And that will be the next big leap.
How many Indians now have access to the internet? Is it like 200 million?
Roughly about 300 million, out of which I think about 125 million have broadband access. I'm talking about broadband access. 1 billion people.
It's just one sign of what India's got that China doesn't. A functioning democracy in a multicultural country, a free press and a long tradition of vigorous public and private debate, an independent court system. On the other side of the ledger, India is infamous for its bureaucracy and red tape. In fact, the last time I was in Bangalore, a dozen years ago, I talked to a co-founder of one of India's most successful tech companies. Narayana Murthy told me what it was like trying to cut through that red tape to get Infosys going in the early 1980s.
Oh, for example, prior to 1991, it would take us about 2 years and about 20 visits to Delhi to obtain license for a $20,000 computer. If you assume that it was about $1,000 per visit, including hotel, going, coming back, everything, you would have spent $20,000, right? Even before you have decided to buy the computer. That's one. Second, when we came to Bangalore, it took us almost 2 years to get a telephone line.
One telephone line.
You see, we had a policy which said a retired civil servant had a higher priority for telephone allotment compared to a company which was exporting. But I must say that the reforms of 1991 have brought in tremendous changes. In my industry, at least by and large, almost, I'd say 95%, government is not a bottleneck.
No kidding. In the time that it took Infosys to get a phone line back in the 1980s, India's national and local governments have helped more than 10,000 startups get going around the country, including in Bangalore's government-funded Startup Warehouse, which is kind of like the Y Combinator in Silicon Valley. It's a cavernous space down an escalator in a new building in a newer part of town that draws high-tech ventures. The Chinese telecoms company Huawei has an office nearby. Here in the Startup Warehouse, the walls are orange. The tables are full of young entrepreneurs with promising ideas. There are classrooms, a range of training sessions, and investors regularly coming in, looking to bet on the next big thing. Ashok Madravali helps run this place. He's deputy director of the National Association of Software and Services Companies, or NASSCOM.
NASSCOM is the IT trade body for the country. It's a preeminent IT trade body. It's helped grow the Indian software IT industry from $1 billion industry to what is now a $140+ billion industry. So we focus on helping early stage technology startups through our new program called 10,000 Startups. And we named it 10,000 Startups because we are a country of 1.2 billion people, so we have to create impact. So this program has been there for the last 3 years now. At this point, we have more than 12,000 startups from 85 cities which have registered with us.
You called this 10,000 startups, and after 3 years, you have 12,000 startups.
So the idea is to impact 10,000 startups. So we are not counting registrations, but the idea is how can we in the next 10 years, 2013 to 2023, we want to impact 10,000 startups. And when I say impact, we want to help them get funded, get them connected to potential customers, get them significantly mentored, and help them grow at a global scale. So those are the few key things that we do. We focus on early stage technology product startups, which have a IT or a software component to it.
I've got to ask, and this is going to sound a little snarky, but I don't mean it that way. When I was last in Bangalore, which was 10 years ago, I was hearing a lot of people in IT saying, look, there's a lot of energy in the private sector. If anything, the government gets in the way. This doesn't sound like the government getting in the way. This sounds like the government enabling people.
Both at the central government level and at the state government, policies which have rolled out, especially in the last 2 years, have been incredibly supportive. And this very space that you're sitting in, this is a startup warehouse, which is a co-working space for tech startups, is funded entirely by the state government. So they put in $1 million a year. And we subsidize it for the startups. We give seats to startups at $75 per seat. It is like ridiculously low. And it's right in the center of Bangalore with all the technical tech talent within a 10-kilometer radius. That makes it really easy for startups to come, network, interact, meet mentors, meet investors.
Like, for instance, a company called BookPad. It was co-founded by three friends who were recent graduates from the Indian Institute of Technology at Guwahati. The technology they came up with allows you to preview files in various applications, Mail, Dropbox, LinkedIn, a little like what Google Docs has, but for broader use. They sold it to Yahoo a couple of years ago. One of the co-founders, Niket Sabanini, happened to be in the startup warehouse visiting when I was there.
Yeah, so we started 2 years ago in Bangalore. So we were in, you know, this space was upstairs on in the other building. It was a very small space. We started.
You started in the startup warehouse.
I started in the startup warehouse. We moved from a garage to the startup warehouse, and then you know we started building a product and we grew a team, and then we started finding a lot of US customers. And then about a year ago, NASSCOM had this program called the InnoTrek, where they take a few entrepreneurs from India to the US. So that's where I met a lot of US clients, and you know I found a lot of interest. And then I met Yahoo there, and you know I knew that they don't have a product like Google Docs, and Yahoo needs it. So that's when I pitched for them to use my product. But then they were more interested in acquisition because it made more sense for both parties that way. We got acquired a year and a half ago. Then I've been with Yahoo ever since. And we integrated our product with Yahoo about 6 months ago. Yeah, so now I'm working in Sunnyvale with Yahoo.
Really? You're based in Sunnyvale now?
Yeah, I'm based in Sunnyvale. I stay in San Jose. The office is in Sunnyvale. Yeah, and I'm just here for a short trip. It's very nice to meet all these, you know, budding entrepreneurs, and you know, excited to start again. So I'm just looking around for opportunities.
To start a new company.
Start a new company. And I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs there in the U.S. I talk to a lot of investors in the U.S. And I find the space more exciting. I find that, you know, the energy and, you know, sort of the number of, sheer number of people starting up here are far more. So, yeah, so the aim is to come back to India and to Bangalore and start something again.
So you're choosing Bangalore over Silicon Valley?
Yeah. Sure, absolutely. Because there's a big slowdown in the U.S. market. The consumer segment isn't doing that great. A lot of companies like Dropbox, Twitter, LinkedIn, they're struggling a lot. I mean, that's what I've heard about the consumer space.
Yeah.
If you say that you're working in the consumer space, and you know, if you're not focusing on India or China, they aren't really excited. So that clearly shows you that, you know, people really want to put their money in the Indian markets.
In fact, Chinese companies and investors are pouring into India. They've channeled 3 times more money into India in the past year than in the previous 15 years combined. Other Asian countries are showing more interest in India, too. Quite a few of India's high-tech and biotech startups are catching international attention. And then there are social entrepreneurs looking for ways to better connect socially conscious investors with grassroots needs in India's poorest areas. I was actually struck as I moved around Bangalore and talked to entrepreneurs how often that theme came up. A lot of people weren't just thinking about how do I create the next unicorn, the next billion-dollar company, but also how do we help lift up more of India's poorest people? How do we solve basic problems that could allow more people to live fuller, longer, healthier lives? One of the places I went at Srivatsakrishna's recommendation was way down south to Electronic City, where I went to something called the Bangalore Bio-Innovation Center. This place, too, is government-funded, and it's helping various biotech companies get going. So here, there's a startup called Omics, which is developing diagnostic chips with the DNA of different pathogens on them that would let doctors in remote rural villages make faster diagnoses of life-threatening diseases. I'll let a senior scientist here, Viapuri, explain.
It's going to be a DNA-based test. So we are going to detect the pathogen DNA on the chip, which the pathogen DNA, which is responsible for the disease that you're looking for. Let's say if it's HIV. So if I'm looking for HIV virus, then it's going to be the RNA that I'll be looking for. So I'll be detecting that particular pathogen-specific nucleic acid on the chip.
Okay, so I'm not a scientist, so you're going to have to walk me through this a little bit. So I'm someone in a village. I come into a clinic.
Yeah.
You take my blood?
Yes.
And then?
So our ultimate goal would be to just put a drop of blood on the chip, and within a few minutes you would know whether it's, you know, positive or negative for that particular pathogen.
What difference do you expect this to make at the local level in a clinic in terms of having the test results that much more quickly?
Doctor can start the antibiotic treatment right then, the same day. The day a patient enters the clinic, gets diagnosed, the treatment can be started immediately.
For certain kinds of malaria, that could be a matter of life and death.
Malaria, bacterial infections, sepsis, bacterial sepsis. That's, you know, devastating. If somebody has sepsis and that gets detected the same day, treatment can be started immediately. And, I mean, you can save a life.
Now, there are other similar products on the market, but this one is meant to work in hot, humid, dusty villages without additional expensive equipment. And it's meant to be affordable. They're not quite sure yet on the price, but they want it to be lower than anything else that's being offered. And one additional thing, I look around the lab at the scientists who are working to perfect this technology.
And I noticed this is an all-female group.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Is that by design or by...
No, just by chance.
Okay. We know women have the best brains, so we just went for that.
Although women here in India, as in many countries, make up a small minority of scientists and startup entrepreneurs. That said, there's another just down the hall working on a technology that could also help a whole lot of people.
My name is Raji, Rajlakshmi Borthakur. We love to call ourselves the Terribles. Yeah, because the name of our company is Terra Blue XT.
Rajlakshmi has been in IT for much of her career. She worked for Infosys and Ernst & Young, and then she became a mom.
So I have a son. He is 5 years now, and he has refractory or hard-to-treat epilepsy. He had epilepsy since birth, and doctors were not able to diagnose him. And because of the kind of attacks he used to get, he became developmentally delayed. And now, though he's 5, he still can't talk. He can't walk properly. He wobbles. And he has several other difficulties. He used to get these statuses, prolonged epilepsy, that would last for several minutes. And we had to rush him to emergency because it would be life-threatening for him otherwise. So we were looking for some answers. We wanted some kind of an indication that would tell us that, he's about to have an attack, so that at least we could wear our clothes, get out of our pajamas, wear our clothes and take him to the hospital. We at least needed that much time. And there was nothing, there's of course nothing available in the market. So since I came from an IT background, while I was still working, I used to read profusely about epilepsy, and I am an IoT, Internet of Things enthusiast, also on the side, okay. And I was reading up about sensors. I knew about epilepsy. I knew about neural networks. So somewhere, sometime, this all came together, that epilepsy is related to electrical signals. Electrical signals could be extracted with the help of sensors. And once you pass this on to a processing hub, maybe, we could predict epilepsy. So that was the beginning.
Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, yeah. So I started working on it myself. So I proved the concept, got a doctor involved, asked him to validate the solution for me, and he did. He said that my solution was right, and it could indeed be done. I was actually able to stream data from my own body. And he was like, yeah, it looks very promising. So that was just the beginning for me. And then at that time, I entered into this competition called Innovate for Digital India. It's supported by Intel and the Department of Science and Technology. So my idea got selected out of 1,900 plus. I got a mail. You are one of the top 700. Very happy. Then we became the top 50. Then we came to the top 20 and then the top 10.
And now here she is getting ready for her company to launch a glove with embedded sensors that can detect an oncoming epileptic seizure. This and other wearables that might be developed in the future could make life easier for many of the 50 to 60 million people on Earth with epilepsy, and for those who care for them. Doctors could monitor patients, even in remote villages. And here's a bonus. The collected data from all the epilepsy patients using this device could help doctors better recognize patterns and prescribe treatment. It's potentially a pretty big deal. The center that's allowing these startups to do their work is also a pretty big deal, and it's new.
So I came here 2 years back around, and that time this biotech park was not functional.
Jitendra Kumar is the director here.
So when I joined with the support of Government of Karnataka, Department of IT, BT, ST, and in association with the IBAB, we constructed this whole facility as well as installed the equipment, made it operationalized, and brought the companies within the span of 2 years. We have around seven, eight companies here, and 10 are in pipeline. So within 2 years, we have 18 companies, the world-class facility here in India, in the southern part of Electronic City, which is a hub of innovation right now.
In other words, this bioinnovation center, with the potential of the startups in it to positively impact millions of lives, it too got up and running in the same amount of time it used to take to get a phone line in this town. Jitendra Kumar says Bangalore is now on the cutting edge in India.
If you're talking about biotechnology and IT, I definitely think it's far ahead any other hubs in India. And it's very, very close to other hubs in global hubs. If you term the number of people involved in biotechnology, I think it's the largest in the globe.
Of course, there are still challenges.
The biggest challenge we face is the source of capital for the innovative ideas and technologies, because the venture funding is still not very mature in India. And we also find that the venture funding is not very accessible from other parts of the world. Actually, this is a problem in all the countries, but this may be a problem a little bit more in India because of the past, you know, historical reasons.
Wait, what do you mean?
The historical reason is because we were not very aggressive about, you know, market capitalization, or the regime was not there because it was a license permit Raj.
License permit Raj. It's a great turn of phrase. It means the reign of government bureaucracy and red tape. That Raj lasted a long while, but the government now seems to be trying to make up for lost time. I strolled over to the Indian Institute of Information Technology, just down the street from the Bioinnovation Center and next to Infosys, and I talked to the institute's director, Professor S. Sadagopan, who got his PhD at Purdue, about how he views India's prospects in this century.
At least as the old guys like we are, 60 plus, who have kind of seen little more than half of last century, the earlier part of 20th century was primarily UK, and the later half was primarily America's century, US century. And not because I'm an Indian, I pretty much feel that this century is going to be split between China and India.
And why do you think so?
Many reasons. One is we seem to have the people advantage. The second, there is an enormous desire to catch up. The spirit of enterprise, the spirit of startup actually dominated the earlier part of last century in UK, and exactly the same thing repeated in United States. To me, finally, everything boils down to people and their energy. So people advantage, focus, wanting to change, wanting to improve, wanting to conquer.
When you say people advantage, are you talking about sheer numbers or something besides that?
A little more than that. You see, the number always is kind of an advantage. But the way UK overcame was, in spite of small numbers, you can still do it. See, just look at the sheer audacity of a Britisher to say the sun will never set on the British soil. I'm not necessarily saying one has to be jingoistic. One should not really get into the mood of dominating the world, not in that spirit. But the spirit is a positive influencing the world. I think that is precisely what is happening. And because I'm an IT guy, I'm likely to be biased. I would say this century is going to be hardware and software century. And that is the reason why it is going to be China and India century.
Just for the sake of argument, why not it being a continuation of the US century?
Okay, it's interesting. Some of us have been kind of visiting United States for the last 40 plus years. And one thing we do find is, I'm not saying US is kind of slowing down or any such thing, but I do find the spirit that I used to find in United States in 70s and 80s and even in 90s, I do not necessarily find the same thing today. I think it is just natural, right? You have a lotus eaters generation. So when everything is well organized, you don't really have to struggle to organize yourself. And the opportunity to contribute, the opportunity to change, the opportunity to fix things, the opportunity to improve things, definitely goes down once you are fairly settled. Otherwise, how can you explain a great country like Switzerland? You know, a country which works like the precision of a clock.
Switzerland, clocks. Is anyone else thinking of Orson Welles in The Third Man?
What the fella said, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias. They had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
Except, of course, Professor Sadagopan is not arguing against peace and democracy, just saying that India's chaos can sometimes work in its favor.
As a matter of fact, you find a country like this country, if you kind of impose emergency and make everything into an order, I think this country deteriorates, because this country thrives in chaos. If I take this example, to a large extent, see, in software, what happens is you don't know exactly what you want. The more I give, the more you want. And something I give, you don't want, but I can fix it. So I keep giving you. So it kind of evolves over a period of time. I think that is an area where India seems to thrive. Whereas we also need lots of things. Things must be delivered exactly. You know, the railroads must work. Even there is 1 millimeter, 1 centimeter difference in the rails, the train will derail. Okay, those kind of perfection is also needed. And that's what China does.
So when it comes to innovation, which is obviously something that you focus on here, do you see India having an advantage?
To some extent, chaos and innovation kind of go together. Because in a chaotic situation, the chances are that you have a much better chances to innovate. And that is one area where India seems to have an edge over China. And what happens is that you think different. Look around the way cable TV is run in this country. It is not by any major corporation. Army of fellows, first-rate idiots who don't understand anything, but somehow make things work. Because, you know, a large country of billion plus, you really can't have extremely intelligent, everybody school-educated, college-educated, intellectual. You will have a large number of idiots. They may be born with extraordinary intellect, but they may not be well-prepared by way of training, etc. But I think we need to take them along. And they are the people who innovate very differently. You must have heard of the famous story in Punjab where people actually used a washing machine to actually make some dough for something. Okay, so this kind of innovation happens because of this chaos and because of lack of formal training.
Yeah. In China, over the course of the last 18 years now, there's been a top government priority and many billions of dollars put into trying to make China a more innovation-driven country. Are you seeing anything coming out of there where you think, whoa, they're ahead of us?
Okay, you see, some of the efforts to kind of structure innovation can work both ways. One set of people feel, and rightly so, that if you try to structure innovation, if you try to dictate innovation, it will never happen. To a large extent, innovation happens out of box. You know, you can't structure it. At the same time, if you enable innovation, if you encourage innovation, if you reward innovation, so obviously a lot more innovation will happen. So that part of the exercise, Chinese are doing well. Whereas in India, it is just the opposite. Okay? Because it is chaos, because it is not necessarily planned well, one kind of innovation happens. At the same time, I'll also tell you what is sad in this country. A lot of innovative ideas never see the light of the day because nobody gives encouragement. Nobody gives encouragement to out-of-box thinking. And to a large extent, this country is run by what we call the top 1% people. The top 1%, if you don't bubble up, okay, you just have no chance of making. We need to encourage innovation.
Here at this institute, he says, he's encouraging work toward innovations that will help the most people and the most vulnerable people.
Those are the areas where some of the startups are working, so which I think would make a difference. Would it make a Facebook? Would it make a Google? Honestly speaking, I don't care. Does it make a difference to a billion people? I care.
So I was hearing before you came in about work being done on water conservation, figuring out where water is. I mean, that obviously affects people all over the world.
I think you have seen India and China, given in China, it is partly true. Inadequate or poor quality water is the main source of a lot of health problem. The chances are, if I attack it, I'm actually going to have a healthy Indian and a healthy Chinese. And a healthy Indian and a healthy Chinese is good for the planet. And a healthy American is good for planet too. You know, so what I'm saying is, any healthy anybody is good for the planet. And by actually improving the health, we'll make a huge difference. And areas like water, that is precisely what is going to happen.
Is there anything you're not doing yet that you'd like to see the Institute do?
One of the things which I find just starting in this country, Indians are actually starting to solve India's problems. You know, our generation of Indians went to the United States, most of us stayed back and contributing to American universities, American corporations, American R&D. Great job. The second generation of companies like Infosys were getting orders from American companies, doing a good job and earning a lot of dollars, making a difference to a few hundreds of thousands of Indians. Good job. But I think we did not solve India's problem. But I find the startups today are trying to solve India's problem, whether it is in education, healthcare, governance, etc.
There are other problems too, of course. Income disparity, tensions among religious and ethnic groups, a rise in Hindu nationalism that's troubling to many non-Hindus in India, an entrenched class system that echoes the old caste system. But Bangalore's experience shows what can happen when the government works to empower rather than getting in the way of the enormous potential that exists in India, especially in India's younger generations. Which brings me back to Srivatsa Krishna, the government official in Bangalore who started us off.
The vision of Prime Minister Modi is extremely significant, and I think it's something which is going to give a huge thrust to the startup initiative and the startup ecosystem in India. Depending on which report you believe in, India is ranked either third or fourth in the world when it comes to startups. We are behind, of course, Silicon Valley in the United States, Israel. Some say we are third, some say we are fourth after Singapore.
So not China.
I don't think when it comes to startups, look, when it comes to manufacturing, they are the factory of the world and we are the brains of the world. So I think it's a very happy combination. The factory of the world and the brains of the world come together. I think the world GDP will go up, the jobs will go up. It's something very, very good. I don't think it's fair to compare India and China on this respect because they're just two different histories. They've evolved completely differently. They have had a very different political regimes. They've had very different policy initiatives. And they've had very different sums of money backing them. The kind of money that China spends on infrastructure every single working day is about $1 billion, $1 billion per working day for the last decade or more. India doesn't have that kind of money to spend. So I think in some areas, China is very well ahead of India and we should emulate them, learn from them, try to do better than them. In other areas, when it comes to IT, knowledge, innovation, startups, I don't think China has a patch on India.
I know plenty of Chinese entrepreneurs who would take issue with that. Some were sitting in that conference room in San Francisco when Srivatsa Krishna gave his pitch on Bangalore. My take? There's plenty of ability, plenty of potential in each country, and each also has its own distinct set of challenges. How they overcome those challenges, how they compete or cooperate with each other, and how the innovations that come out of each change and perhaps improve life around the globe looks likely to be one of the most important driving forces of this century. India is just making it clear these days that it's in the game, and it's a game worth watching. That's our podcast. Comments, suggestions? Contact me on Twitter at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and most other podcast apps. I'd be delighted if you did. You can listen on Stitcher or visit our webpage, pri.org/century, to see more on this topic and others. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in collaboration with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Come on back and listen in.